evening, we have another live subject on our hands. We will have to get into it as quickly and basically as possible. We have been discussing the Indian system of yoga, and we have been attempting to point out that the entire system, like that of Neoplatonism among the Alexandrian Greeks, arises from the conviction that it is possible for the human being to unfold faculties and powers not generally recognized or available. This, to a great degree, distinguishes the ancient and the modern concepts of learning. For in the modern concept, man may unfold powers, but only through the extension of his temporal knowledge. In the East, the individual is taught that he can unfold himself through the investigation of his own internal life, and the gradual ordering of it by certain specific disciplines. Raja Yoga is properly called the princely discipline, or the royal way of union, from Raja, princely, or royal, and yoga, union. And in it, all of the paths of yoga meet. It is the lord over the yogas, or the waves of human growth. Today, in practice, even in Asia, the unity of the various systems under the Raja Yoga concept is not generally recognized. But tonight we must deal with the direct and a positive approach to the concept of illumination, recognizing that the other yogas are very largely cathartic disciplines, that is, methods of purification, whereas Raja Yoga recapitulates them all through its steps and stages, and then passes on to the positive consideration of human enlightenment. We know also that, all of the contrary notwithstanding, that the actual disciplines of Raja Yoga are not available in the West. And many works relating to the subject have been written, and some Eastern teachers have attempted to explain it. But all those who were legitimate representatives of their proper schools in Asia were under certain obligations regarding the dissemination of this knowledge. Therefore, they could proceed a way only, and then were required by their own vows to remain silent. Probably this is just as well, because actually, as the Swami Vivekananda learned to his sorrow, Occidental man is differently constituted psychologically, and certainly far different in his general outlook on life from Eastern man. His body is not under the discipline that is familiar to the Oriental. His mind and emotions are not under discipline. And therefore, the immediate attempt to enforce these Eastern rules upon his conduct and character is almost certain to result in trouble. But for this evening, we want to study the principles involved in this theory. Because these principles are true, or they are not true. If they are true, then it is the proper duty of Western man to find a method of adapting these principles to his own requirements. This process has gone on to some degree. It even went on in India, where we find the basic teachings of yoga gradually modified through various sects, drifting in a still more modified form into the great stream of Buddhist metaphysics. Raja Yoga assumes at the beginning much that was assumed in early Western science, namely that man is a miniature of a larger universal pattern. That man is a miniature universe, and the universe is a grand person. This larger universe contains within it all of the energies, powers, laws, and principles required for its own continuance and maintenance. A man possesses within himself also, hidden but real, the energies, powers, and principles necessary for his own enlightenment. And the method of growth within man is identical in principle with the method of growth in nature. And the unfoldment of the human being is according to natural law. The difference between discipline and the haphazard existence that we have called life lies in the fact that under discipline, man comes into a voluntary and positive relationship with the laws governing his own existence. A Greek philosopher was once asked to define the difference between a wise and a foolish man. And he replied that a wise man loves to do those very things that foolish men have to do against their wills. And this is a more or less basic statement. The individual who is untrained, undisciplined, unenlightened, is constantly confronted with challenge. He must gradually learn by trial and error the way he should go. He must correct his own mistakes. He must gradually learn to control his own nature and his own appetites. If, however, he has a resolution within him, a determination to cooperate with the plan of his own existence, then two things are necessary. First, that he shall have some knowledge of this plan, and second, that he shall have the courage, the conviction, the energy, and the endurance to accomplish those ends which he recognizes to be right and proper. The theoretical part of the yogas, therefore, deals with that instruction, that knowledge, by which the individual comes to know the science of his own salvation. He comes to understand the instruments and tools with which he must work. And he gains a strong theoretical understanding of the principles and methods by which he can attain such ends as he recognizes to be right and proper. Thus in yoga, we have this twofold problem. The problem of instruction, and then comes the problem of action. The individual will not become wise through instruction alone. He may become very unhappy as a result of action alone. But if instruction and action are united and formed into a proper partnership, then the individual does that which he knows and knows that which he does. Under such condition, his advancement and his progress are reasonable. The Raja Yoga begins to deal with something a little bit beyond the obvious and the apparent. And in order to make it as simple as we can, at the same time, to give a broad basis for further thought and research, one of those who are so interested, we're going to pause for just a moment and consider some opinions of Pythagoras, who was strongly influenced by Eastern philosophy, having been initiated into the Hindu mysteries in Ellora and Alpana. Pythagoras gave us a formula for the construction of the human soul. And he declared this soul to be a symmetrical geometric solid. He also recognized that the soul itself contained or possessed seven energies, and that these energies could be caused to correspond symbolically with the orbits of the seven planets in the solar system. Pythagoras created the concept that the elements correspond to the human body, that the seven planetary orbits correspond to the human soul, and that the constellational firmament corresponds to the human spirit. Paracelsus of Hohenheim, the Swiss physician, followed much this same concept. Therefore, he declared that between the spiritual and material lives of man, there was an interval which was crossed or bridged by the orbits of the planets, and that the planets, therefore, could properly be regarded as symbolic of the human soul. Also, Pythagoras created what he called a monochord, or a single spring which he stretched between the earth below and the firmament above. He then placed frets upon this string, breaks upon the musical chords. These frets he placed according to the orbits of the planets, creating a musical system, which finds its analogy in India in the famous veena, or in musical instrument of Shiva. We find there also the belief that this group of levels or planes, these orbits, or this complete octave divided into its departments, its tonal intervals, and things of that nature, corresponded to the structure of the human soul. Pythagoras then also recognized what he called the eighth part of the soul, which was its generative function, by means of which it made possible the perpetuation of bodies. Today in psychology, we think of the soul as a sort of compound of the mental, intellectual, and emotional, passional complex in man. Even today, it is not always evident that psychologists distinguish between the mind and the emotions as parts of the soul structure. But the term soul, psychologically, is generally applied to these subconscious or subjective sources of mind and emotion. And the individual is therefore a living soul within a body. And the soul is associated more and more definitely with the person. So that a soul within a body is a person within a body. Now to return to Raja Yoga for a moment. We know that in the yoga system, there is a very elaborate discussion of a kind of physiology, a psychophysiology or a neurophysiology, and that this physiology deals with certain internal functions of man, and arranges this internal physiological structure in the form of a mysterious inverted tree with its root in the brain and its trunk extending down the spinal cord. This trunk consists of a great or mysterious nerve through which and in which passes a very wonderful and mysterious power, which is called the Kundali Shakti. This power, or the fireness, the fire of life in man, is then distributed from the central nadi, or the Shoshumna nerve, through smaller nerves throughout the body, until the entire structure of man's animation is supported by this intricate network of nerves carrying within them a mysterious, invisible energy. Now, in this concept, we are dealing not primarily with the physical nervous system of the body. We are dealing, rather, with a distribution in the soul itself. And the mysterious chakras, or wheels, upon the spinal cord, the various plexi and ganglia involved in the yoga system, are not actually physical centers in the body. They are more correctly and definitely psychic centers within the body, existing within the broad structure of what we call the soul itself. Thus, your anatomy and physiology in yoga is upon a psychic level. And because it is upon a psychic level, it is influenced, changed, modified, directed, governed, distributed by means of the mysterious power of the human will. Now, when we go into the study of this a little more carefully, we can get a somewhat simpler picture. Now, all pictures, all symbols are inadequate, let us face it. Therefore, in any symbolism which I may try to draw for you, something is going to be wrong, because symbolism is not identical with the subject under consideration. There must always be a limitation in the symbolism. And recognizing that, however, it is still possible to convey an idea, a certain degree of reality. And it is important that the listener should not extend the analogy beyond the point we take it, in other words. because if he does, he may then run into conflict because of symbolical limitations. Just go as far as we recommend with this, and then let it rest for the moment. Let us now imagine that man contains within himself the elements of a cosmos. And he has a body composed of elements. These elements, in the symbolism of antiquity, were four in number: earth, fire, air, and water. To which the alchemists added a mysterious fifth element, which they called Azoth, and which in the East is more or less associated with the idea of Akasha. Now this body of elements forms the corporeal constitution of man. In modern Western science, we have many more elements, but the principle of the symbolism is the same. So the body of man consists of something that resembles the physical planet Earth itself, with its elements, with its parts, and like the Earth itself, supporting innumerable living things upon and within it. The psychic life of man corresponds with the solar system which surrounds the Earth and is the abode of certain wandering bodies called planets. And these planets, in a mysterious way, constitute together a psychic atmosphere. And both Eastern and Western astrological speculation points out that the positions, motions, and mutations of these planets may affect corporeal things. So that the psychic life of man really consists of a kind of solar system. And this psychic life, therefore, has within it seven distinguishable levels or regions of qualities. And these levels or regions become the basis for the vitalization of the seven psychic powers of man's experience. In other words, from one level may come his rational powers. From another, his emotional intensities. From a third, his imaginative faculties. From a fourth, his intellectual concepts, as differentiated from his rationality. From each of these levels of the soul, therefore, energies are constantly made manifest, and man lives psychically by the expenditure and release of these energies upon various levels of his own consciousness. Thus, from within the psychic life of the individual, there is constantly flowing a sevenfold stream of psychic energy and vitality, capable of sustaining the seven essential functions of the soul itself. Thus we have, for example, if we want to consider it, something in this order. The reflective power of the soul, or contemplative faculty, which is associated with Saturn. The rational, reasonable, philosophical aspect of the soul, which is associated with Jupiter. The dynamic, aggressive, combative instincts of the soul associated with Mars. The vital or life principle of the soul itself, which we would commonly term libido, with the sun. The adatory powers of the soul with Venus. The concrete intellectual the so-called ordinary thinking of the soul with Mercury. The imaginative power with the moon, and the generative power, the eighth, the one which was not included in the original pattern, is the overlapping of the soul's energy with the physical structure of nature. Now, if these conditions may be said to exist within man, we can then begin to understand, perhaps, the story of the Babylonian myth of Ishtar at the Seven Gates. We find in the ancient story that Tammuz, the hero god, died and was carried to the underworld, where he came across the threshold of the world of sin. Now, sin in this case doesn't mean evil. Sin was the god of death in the Babylonian concept. And Ishtar, because of her great love for Tammuz, made the hazardous pilgrimage down through the seven spheres in order to rescue Tammuz from the land of no return. And at each gate, as she descended, the guardians of the gate took from her one of her symbols of royalty and power. The first gate or crown was removed from her, and so on until at the time when she reached the last or the seventh gate and entered into the sphere of darkness, where she had been deprived of all of her adornments and her raiment, and entered naked into the world of death. Now, of course, this is a highly symbolical account. But here we have, perhaps, a story which can be closely associated with our principle of Raja Yoga, as you will see a little later. Now, we can take another parallel to this, which can be of interest to us. In the Phaenandries of Hermes, one of the works of the Alexandrian Hermetic School, about the beginning of the Christian era, we have the mysterious account of the journey of the soul, or the journey of the consciousness, through the seven gates of the planetary orbits. And we also learn from this work that when man was created by the gods, he descended through the seven orbits, and each of these orbits bestowed a soul power upon him, until when he finally reached the earth, he was a body containing the power of the seven genii of the soul spheres, or the orbits of the planets. Now we can take another example, which is also quite parallel, but perhaps not as detailed, and that is the vision of John on Patmos. Here we find that John the Evangelist is lifted up through a mysterious circumstance associated with the mystery of the seven churches which are in Asia. Now, these seven churches are actually, again, references to the seven powers of the soul. And having been raised upward to the firmament, he passed through a little door in the firmament and came out into the spiritual world above. Now, anyone who has been a student of Raja Yoga will know exactly what this is telling about, because they will realize that the entrance to the world above corresponds to the unfolding of the thousand-petal lotus in the brain. Now, we have another parallel that comes to us from the apocryphal writings of Islam, the famous night journey of Muhammad to heaven. He is said to have reached Jerusalem on the back of a mysterious being with a human head and the body of a horse and the tail of a peacock called El-Morak. Even when he stood upon the rock Moriah, or the stone of the threshing floor of the Jebusite at Solomon's temple, he beheld a ladder of silken cords fall from heaven. And he ascended through this, through the gates of the seven planets. And at each one of the gates stood one of the prophets. And these prophets permitted him to enter. Yeah. And finally he ascended through the seventh gate, at the gate of which, incidentally, was Jesus. And then he was allowed to enter into the mystery of the divine presence that lay beyond. These are all stories of the journey, the perilous journey of the psychic nature through its own bodies or levels. Here then we begin to see a picture that perhaps makes a little bit of meaning. We remember also the Mithraic ladder of seven rungs used in the Persian mysteries. And we are constantly in the presence of this ladder upon which the angels ascend and descend, as in the vision of Jacob. Thus, let us for a moment recognize something that we might not at first realize or understand, namely that the psyche of man is actually a septenary structure, that it is in levels, and that these levels are the sources or causes of certain specialized psychic energy. And that this psychic energy, in its various manifestations, has much to do, in fact, everything to do, with the levels of life upon which we live. Now, to take the ordinary experience of man, he is never aware of this stratification of his own soul. And someday, it is my profound suspicion that psychologists are going to return to the Pythagorean geometric pattern for the soul. But in the meantime, we only know that a conglomeration of impulses come out from within us, that these impulses are often conflicting, and that in their totality, they represent limitations. Let us approach it in this way. Always this ladder of souls, or this soul quality ladder, through which the individual must pass, or the rungs of which he must climb. Always these rungs have to do either with the diminishing of reality, as in the case of the descent of this star, or the diminishing of illusion, as in the ascent of Mohammed, or the revelation of St. John. Brought down to the level of ethics, brought down to the practical level of human living, each individual is a victim of the intensities of his own soul nature. And while this soul nature is and can be a tremendous and wonderful power within him, we have to tie the seven parts of the soul again with the seven deadly sins of theology and the seven cardinal virtues. For the seven cardinal virtues are nothing but the redemption of the seven deadly sins. And over the control and direction and administration of this psychic pattern are the original seven sacraments of the Church. There is a pattern here which we'll have to introduce you to step by step, but I think you will begin to see what we are talking about. Now, the seven deadly sins certainly do not originate in the body, nor do the seven cardinal virtues come as the result of diet, bathing, and exercise. There is something much more profound involved than this. Actually, all of these powers, principles, and qualities exist within the psychic zone rather than within the physical body of the individual. And the physical body is plagued by the excesses of the soul, even as it is redeemed and purified by the moderation of the soul. It is this psychic life, therefore, that presents the individual with a stratified pattern of illusion. Now, in the initiations of Buddha, in the Saptapana Kavan, the seven rooms of initiation in the Indian story, and in the various chambers of initiation in the ancient rituals and rites of practically all mysteries, the neophyte passed through these rooms of ordeals in which he was tested and tried, in which he was subjected to all kinds of fantasy and illusion. And behind the Eastern concept of the soul lies the fact that this sphere, with its seven qualities, represents essentially Maya, or the world of illusion. Now, the reason why it is the world of illusion is because it is the world of seeming, the world of things that are not true or real in themselves. The soul consists of energies which have intensity, but which in themselves do not essentially solve their own problem or bring reality out of the chaos of their own intensities. Therefore, regeneration, as in alchemy, which we will begin to consider next week, where we study the mystery of the transmutation of the seven metals, which are again these same principles, and the gradual bringing of these metals together to form the lapis philosophorum, or the stone of the wise, that in the transmutation of base metals, we have exactly the problem of the soul. For alchemy is working with the mystery of the soul, and the philosopher's stone is the perfected soul. In the New Testament, the soul appears as the wedding garment in connection with the famous marriage of the bridegroom and the lamb. The mystery of the soul is also given to us symbolically in the description of the vestments of the high priest of Israel, where each of his garments and each of the symbolic adornments of the tabernacle and the various furnishings and curtains of the Temple of Solomon all refer to the same basic situation. Now, man as a being is seeking to achieve self-consciousness at first. That is his first goal. It is not his ultimate goal, as we've already expressed. But there must be the gradual integration of the psychic nature before the individual can pass through the mystery of the orbits of the planets and pass again through the little door that leads above the firmament, as described in the Apocalypse. So what have we here? in the book of Revelation, we have the mystery of the opening of the seven seals, the mystery of the seven vials, the mystery of the septenary, the seven trumpets. We have the great being of the mysteries, walking amidst the seven branches of the candlestick. We have the seven-branch candlestick with its seven lights. All of these belong to the soul level of human experience and consciousness. So in the yogas, we have this little simple problem on our hands. Namely, that in the life of man, the soul, the wanderer, described by the Greeks as always walking with a limp, the cripple, is actually man's own undisciplined, imperfect psychic existence. A psychic existence which is now capable of getting into so many difficulties that hundreds of books have been written describing the various ailments which involve everything from neuroses to fixations to phobias to manias, and the whole group of mental disease from paranoia to the manic depressive. We also know that man's dreams arising in his psychic life are notable for their disturbances, for their confusions, for the fantasy and phantasmagoria in them. Also, that in his daily living, most of his existence is dominated by his imaginations, and that in looking at various things, he sees them not as they are, but according to his own believing, according to the pressures of his own psychic life, so that for him, good may appear bad, and bad may appear good. Thus, there is this incredible undisciplined interval, recognizable as a septenary structure through which the individual must ascend by a series of experiences. In other words, these seven levels represent the seven rooms of his house in which are living persons who are not entirely civilized and certainly not coordinated to his major objectives. He must meet with each of them, convert it, and cause it to become a disciple of his purpose, or he cannot go on. In this, then, we have the ordering of the soul, the gradual process of the application of will, which is the magic wand of the magician, to the energies which normally control him, and over which he must finally become the controlling power. Now we will take, for example, just one of them, which we can say associates very closely in our concept with the lower chakra of the spine. And we will now take the concept of imagination. Now, imagination is a wonderful thing. Imagination is the power which can cause the individual to extend himself from things already known toward things as yet to be known. Imagination forms a wonderful aura or a wonderful field, constantly luring the individual to further accomplishment and attainment. Imagination on the level of science has led to great progress. On the level of industry, it has caused men to envision things necessary and bring them to pass. But everything that is accomplished by man first begins as an idea. First begins as a dream about a change for the better in some way. And the energy, the effort necessary to make this progress come through is will sustaining and fulfilling the imagery of the inner life. Yet imagination, about which we could write so many charming accounts of such beautiful achievement, is also a terrible and dangerous thing. Imagination can cause the individual to turn against those who love him best. Imagination can cause him to surround his own life with demons and specters. Imagination can destroy his rest by night and his peace of mind by day. Imagination can finally bring him down a complete victim to hallucination. It can cause him to depart from reasonable and orderly ways of life and wander for the best part of a lifetime or even more than one lifetime in a fool's paradise. Imagination can cause him to see evil in the good, and even as it can cause him to see good in the evil. Thus, imagination is something he has to work with. If he leaves it the way it is, he can never escape it. It will lock him completely. If he proceeds in his spiritual life, he will never know whether the visions that he sees are from God or from the disorder of his own psyche. Imagination can cause him to see things so real that he will believe them more quickly than he will believe a fact. And yet maybe they have no existence at all except within himself. And I don't know any place where imagination is more interesting than is directly in the subject of Raja Yoga. Because I have met hundreds of persons during my time who have imagined that they have passed all the way to Samadhi and come back again, and they never left terra firma. I assure you, they have never gotten themselves for one moment out of the magic garden of their own wishful thinking. Yet they develop symptoms. They attain revelations. They write strange and beautiful reports. They found facts and do all kinds of things. But they have never been beyond the dreaming that results from a little reading and an overtaxing of the common sense. So, what do we do with this? Here is a final soul. Something has to be done about it. So we have the ancient fable that we find in India in a beautiful painting that's in one of the temples over there called Buddha Overcoming the Seven Planets. Here we have realization, the internal contemplation of the individual, gradually conquering the excesses of his own psychic nature. Now he has seven primary excesses, the levels involved to contend with. And each one of these has a progeny which must be also handled. So that in the Kabbalah of Rabbi Akiva, we find that these branches, levels, and departments of the psychic nature are said to be 7 times 7, or the 49 gates that lead finally to liberation. Because until the disciple has passed through the 49 gates, he is not free from the mystery of his own psychic nature. Now, I think you can realize rather quickly how this subject could be enlarged upon. I think you will realize that upon it could be based perhaps one of the most important texts of modern psychology. Releasing us from a great many limitations of thinking, and also bringing to our attention, perhaps for the first time, the ethical significance of psychic organization. That we not only have this problem, but we must face it. Now, let us state, for example, we can't do all of these levels, so we'll just stay with this level of imagination for a while and see how we could approach it within our own psychic nature. Now, let us use a little Hindu symbolism to work with this and realize that this psychic center of imagination at the base of the spine, corresponding rather closely with the sacrococcygeal ganglia, is, as they would describe it, a basket. It is a basket of nerves. It is a basket ball, not actually, symbolically. Now, don't look for handles on it. Symbolically speaking, it is a basket. And it is a basket in which a very grave and ancient yogin, whom we know as the god Shiva, who is the master of all of the yogis, and who also therefore represents a power by which he is the great yogin, the master of the paths of yoga. But in this case, we have Shiva in one of his lesser forms because he now appears as a genial, kindly old snake charmer. Because in this basket is coiled up the mysterious symbolic cobra of the ancient tradition. This is the serpent of the Kundalini. Now, we find this serpent often likened to a feminine power, as in Wagner's opera Parsifal, where Kundalini, for the snake maiden, is merely Kundalini, dressed in the robes of snakes. Of her own accord, Kundri would serve the knights of the Grail up on the top of the mountain, but under the spell of Clean Sword, the symbol of delusion, she becomes the enemy of all that is good. And the opera unfolds around this until finally the mysterious Eucharist at the final elevation of the Grail, in which Kundri falls at the foot of the altar with her final words, "I serve." which incidentally later became associated with the heraldic device of the Prince of Wales in England. Now, the Kundari Shakti, therefore, coiled in the basket, is interesting to us for the moment, because this is the seat of the spinal fire, the mysterious magic. This is the abode of the great serpent that is to eat up all the little serpents, as in the story of the rod raised in the wilderness. Now, isn't it interesting that this mysterious power should be locked in the center that corresponds with imagination? And it is perfectly proper that it should be, because imagination is the basis of other powers, when it is gradually regenerated. Because from imagination, we gain, through the transmutation of it, the discipline of it, the regeneration of it, the most powerful incentive that man has for growth. For what is faith but imagination brought under the power of the Spirit? In other words, faith is the belief in the reality of things unseen. And without the power to internally image that which is superior to his present state, man cannot grow. Therefore, the internal creative imagination must release all of the spiritual potential in man. So there, locked in the basket of imagination, is the serpent of the mysteries, the serpent of wisdom, the winged seraphs of antiquity, also the sleeping adept, Merlin, in his house of glass. This serpent power, then, locked here, tells us something about what we have to do. We have to learn to charm the snake. We have to learn to either handle this serpent because of our own wisdom and will, or else we will be stung by it and killed. So the snake charmer becomes, in a mysterious symbolic way, man himself, learning to control the tremendous psychic energy which he possesses within his own nature, and which the ancients often symbolized as the serpent twisted around the egg of the world. And so it occurs in some of the Brahmin mythology. So now we come to the problem of yoga. We realize why the yogic disciplines make such tremendous emphasis of man gradually learning to control his own soul. Now, how is he going to control his own soul? We can look upon it as an enemy and begin to plan an elaborate strategy for its redemption or for our own release from its power. We can say to ourselves, let us put this imagination under complete discipline. Let us not permit ourselves to imagine anything that we do not want to imagine. And whatever we do imagine, let us place it immediately under the control of reason. Let us take every impulse, hunch, feeling, and wishful thought that comes to us, sit down, take it apart, make common sense out of it. What happens? Nothing. Precisely nothing. It's exactly like love, which is one of the powers of the soul. The more you define it, the less of it you have, and so when you understand it thoroughly, there isn't any. And really much like human emotion, the more you try to control it, the more rebellious it gets. And the more certainly you know you shouldn't, the more definitely you desire to do so. So there's no answer there. And the Hindu would live too long or live too well to be caught by this illusion, which is little better than one of the others. Because here we have seven powers, all of which are united in a common benignness. There are levels of them, but they are all of them basically immature and incomplete. So, we take seven people who do not know, and we make a committee out of them. What is the result? Do they do any more for us apart together than they did apart? Now, the mind, the mental energy of man, is one of the powers of the soul, also filled with imperfection. So we allow that, then, to run the emotions. What do we have then? Again, the blind leading the blind. Well, this regularly leads us to a bit of a dilemma. Because the seven active powers of man are the powers of the soul, and he has no conscious awareness of any other faculties available to him. He doesn't know what to use in order to transcend this level of his own nature. He can rationalize, but the rational power is part of the soul and also subject to error. He can dramatize, that is more of the same. He can contemplate, that is more of the same. All of these faculties, in their native condition, as the average student has to work with them, are as faulty, each as the other. So to place one under the control of another is only to place one tyrant over another. The facts are not clarified. Now, in the case of imagination, we have another problem on our hands. We decide that we're going to control it. We're only going to imagine those things which are right. Next question, what is right? And how are we going to know? Blind alley again. So we will say, I'm going to take a series of abstract virtues. I shall always be kind. I shall always be gentle. I shall always be patient. I shall always be loving. Now that's fine. But what is kindness? What is patience? What is love? What is gentleness? We love some people so much that we spoil them. We are patient at times when all we do is contribute to the delinquency of someone else. We are gentle when perhaps the occasion calls for firmness. How are we going to know which is which, what is what, and why is why? Answer is, we don't. We're not going to immediately. But here is this little bundle of imagination with a snake in it, still waiting to have something done about it. What are we going to do? The Eastern disciplines tell us there's only one thing to do, and that is to realize that in the universe, all energies represent motions. Therefore, the use of the chakra, or the whirling wheel, to symbolize these centers in the psychic nature. They are all wheels moving up on axes. The only part of the wheel that doesn't whirl is the axis, or the mysterious axle tree upon which all of them turn. Pythagoras pointed this out very clearly when he reminded his disciples that you should never put good and evil on a pair of scales and weigh one against the other, because both ends of the scale represent imbalance. The only point where balance is attained is in the center. Therefore, both extremes are always wrong. Moderation is always right. Now, when it comes to the moderating of an emotion or an intensity, how do we achieve it? We achieve it by removing from it what the modern psychologist calls libido, or energy. Imagination functions because man energizes it with his own will. If he removes his will from any psychic energy field, that psychic energy immediately relaxes. And as a result of relaxation, it retires to its own normal state. Therefore, the only answer to any abnormalcy is to remove the pressure from it. Not by fighting it, not by resisting it, but by simply directing the libido away from it. The libido always representing energy, or the direction of the conscious will of the person. What would the imagination be if you devitalized it? If you simply removed from it all of the energy by which you sustain it and cause it to have a vital existence, would imagination cease? That's a large question. The yoga doctrine says it won't cease. Instead of ceasing, it will simply return to its own essential nature and remain completely placid. And in its placidity, will then become available to be used according to the enlightened power of a superior part or nature. So So in this concept, all of the seven planets must be overcome by will and yoga. They must be overcome by the removal from them of their energy factor. Now let's see what happens, for instance, if you should remove the energy factor from love. This could be a very, very amazing experience. Yet would it mean that love would cease? According to the Eastern thinker, no, it would not cease. The only thing that would cease would be the exaggerations of emotion. In other words, love, not directed by any ulterior pressure, would then become simply itself. And in becoming itself, it would lose its possessive attributes. It would lose its intensities. It would cease to be the kind of love that smothers and kills. It would cease to be the kind of love that desires to own, to overwhelm, to absorb into itself the thing that it is associated with. And it would become something that would be utterly unthinkable to the Occidental. The Occidental experiencing it would probably wonder whether the person cared for it at all or not. Because today, unless we really get excited about something, we don't really care for people. And there are actually human beings living in this world who do not believe that someone loves them unless they beat them up once a week. That is a sign of real devotion. If we care enough about people, for example, to be jealous of them, then we really love them. But what are we going to do about the toxic consequences of jealousy? Because jealousy makes us sick. And if we love something enough, we're going to almost certainly have to hate something. Because we cannot keep an unbalanced emotion moving in one direction all the time. It is bound to swing back. Therefore, if we pass through moods of tremendous exhilaration, we're almost certainly going to have a reaction accompanied by depression. And if we have another reactions of depression and exhilaration, we're going to end up as manic depressives and require hospitalization. So we have the Hindu system, which creates these seven psychic centers, which control the body, function through it, and are responsible for the gradual integration of the seven vital organs of the body, which are the shadows of these psychic centers. And these psychic centers, in turn, reflect themselves into the seven major parts of the brain, and, for that matter, appear again as the seven endocrine glands, the controllers and regulators of the body, by means of which the emotional pressures of the psyche are distributed. Well, in Buddhism, we have another division which is not very different. We have exoterically five, esoterically seven, celestial bodhisattvas, great beings, sitting eternally in meditation. Where the Hindu places his lotus flowers along the spine, the Buddhist would place these seated figures. And the sixth and seventh thrones, the Buddhist leaves empty, because he believes they represent powers of the soul that have not yet been individualized in the human being, but must be in the course of time. And also, that these powers, these seven bodhisattvic energy centers in contemplation, can be said to be the seven redeemed powers of the psychic nature, and therefore are properly and appropriately in a state of internalization. So in the Hindu concept, the integration or the release of the Kundalini Shakti and its gradual ascent is said to be the result of a conquering one by one the levels, or conquering these blossoms or flowers with their various petals, each marked with certain symbols of letters, garlands of tones and sounds, musical notations, and also in the heart of each one of which is seated one of the Vedic deities. These are man's soul. And through this string of soul beads runs the single thread of will. And the problem in the Raja Yoga begins with the problem of bringing these parts of the psychic nature into integration. Because until they are completely and entirely integrated, the pure and absolute consciousness of man cannot come into manifestation. Because until consciousness can vitalize these centers, without these centers becoming excessive through that vitality, or without these centers misinterpreting energy or misusing it, until such time, the pure nature of energy itself, the pure nature of life consciousness, cannot be experienced by man, because it is always going to come in some conditioned form. It is always going to be hidden behind an illusion, or functioning through an unreality, representing one of these psychic gates. In the problem, then, of the imagination pattern, which we have to come back to for a moment, I think, we have this situation. How do we overcome imagination? How do we release the tremendous psychic energy which is located in the beginning of this great chain without conflict, without destroying, without perverting energy with which to destroy energy? You remember that when Amfortas, king of the Grail, resolved to destroy Klingsor, the evil magician in his castle, he took the holy spear of Longinus, the sacred relic, and he went down into the valley with it in order to kill Klingsor with a sacred object. But what happened? He hurled the spear, Klingsor took it from him, turned and wounded him with it. And this is the inevitable result of the individual attempting to use destructive means to achieve constructive ends. The instrument turns upon him. Force is the spear of Longinus. And the force with which we try to destroy evil becomes the force that destroys us. We cannot do it. We cannot use the very means we are seeking to escape to achieve our own liberation. If we do, the thing turns upon us, and we are in trouble again. Now, in the imagination factor lurks the potential of what we may term realization. Realization is man's imaginative power to imagine the complete relaxation of the power of imagination. In other words, he possesses in each faculty of the soul the key to the suppression of the excesses of that faculty. Thus, through imagination itself, he can imagine the repose of his own soul. He can imagine the suspension. And in something which is never quiet, he has the power to imagine stillness.